Hello, everybody. This is Eli Lake of the Washington Times and the New Republic, and I'm here, we're honored here today at Blogging Heads to have Ambassador Aaron David Miller, who has been a Middle East negotiator for Republican and Democratic presidents, as well as now a scholar at the Wilson Center for International Studies and the author of The Much Too Promised Land, which is really a brilliant, it's not just a memoir, it is also a very well-reported book with original interviews with secretaries of state, past presidents, world leaders, members of Congress, and it's something that I think anyone who's interested in the sort of history and the context of the Arab-Israeli conflict really needs to read. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure, Eli.
Well, I'd like to start off and just jump right into it. You wrote a very controversial, in 2005, op-ed piece kind of using this concept of Israel's lawyer, and I thought maybe you could explain that in the context that you meant in terms of the Camp David II talks.
Sure. I borrowed this concept from Henry Kissinger, who in his memoirs strongly suggested that the Israelis wanted American negotiators to become effectively their lawyers, and that there was a danger if we fell into that role. The fact is, we are Israel's lawyer. We have a special relationship with the state of Israel, driven by shared values, value affinity, and that's not going to change. But to be a broker, to be an effective broker, you really have to have only one client, and the client is the agreement itself. You need to effectively become an advocate or a lawyer for both sides. And this concept, which in my judgment is so elemental, if you're going to reach an agreement and you're the third party, you've got to at least try to reconcile the needs and requirements of each side. This notion of Israel's lawyer was greeted with incredible controversy and criticism, and yet it's a basic tenet, not only of negotiation of life. Good friendships, good business propositions are based on a mutuality of interest and need, and unless you can secure that, they're not going to endure.
Now, I want to, before we get into kind of your expanded writing on this in the book, let's talk a little bit about Camp David too. Because in the book, you describe Camp David II as often an unfocused, at times, it sounds like, pretty fun getaway. Great food, bowling, golf. There wasn't as much focus as you'd like. Do you think that one of the things that hindered Camp David was, what were the causes for Camp David not to result in a final settlement of the issue?
Well, the ultimate construct through which I explained the lack of success, the failure of Camp David, was the fact that nobody was really ready for it. Ehud Barak, the then Israeli Prime Minister, came with some very bold proposals, but they were nowhere short of what he wanted them to achieve. Arafat, on the other hand, came to Camp David not to negotiate. Certainly not to reach an agreement, essentially to survive. And I point out in the book that at the end we all should have been given T-shirts, but his would have read, "I survived Camp David."
Right.
And Clinton allowed the summit to run him rather than to run the summit itself. So the reality is nobody was ready for the kind of conflict-ending, make-or-break opportunity at Camp David. And the fact is we can blame the Israelis and particularly the Palestinians all day long. Mm-hmm. From sunrise to sunset, but the reality is this occurred at our house, and we bear responsibility. We've only had two efforts in the past 40 years with respect to presidential summits. One, Camp David in September of 78, in which Jimmy Carter brought Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin, succeeded. The other one, in which Bill Clinton invited Yasser Arafat and Ehud Barak, failed. And there was a huge difference between the two. Carter, Begin, and Sadat were ready to reach an agreement. Barak, Arafat, and Clinton couldn't.
And when you look at that's very interesting, but there are some schools of thought that suggest that, Arafat Arafat was blamed in the aftermath. Clinton blamed Arafat. And then there was sort of a revision of that, I guess you'd call the Malley account, which said that there were unreasonable demands that were made on Arafat. Where do you come, I guess you could say to your two former colleagues, where in the paradigm of the Ross account and the Malley account, where are you?
Well, my view is that there's the orthodox account, which is Barak put the best offer Palestinians would ever get on the table. Arafat rejected it and went to violence. Then there's the revisionist account, which is it's more complicated than that. Everybody had a role and was to blame. Then there's what I would call the determinist account, which is where I am. The prospects of reaching a conflict-ending agreement between Israelis and Palestinians in July of 2000 was slim to none. Slim to none. So for an American president to go to Camp David in those circumstances with that as an objective was frankly well-intentioned, genuine, but reckless.
Interesting. So you thought that it was too ambitious, then you should have had a plan B. There's that wonderful scene in the book before Camp David where was it Sandy Berger who kind of told you, don't perish the thought, don't even bring that up.
I don't want to absolve myself from responsibility here. I was as gung-ho about trying to reach an agreement between Israelis and Palestinians as everyone else. And when Clinton went around the table to ask all of his advisors what they thought, instead, and this I realized, I simply chickened out. Instead of standing up and saying, Mr. President, you can go to Camp David, but we have to start now in planning for what's going to happen if you don't succeed, because you won't succeed. Instead of saying that to him, I basically wimped out and basically echoed what everyone else said, which was, Mr. President, you have to go. Trying and failing is better than not trying at all. There's a historic opportunity here. I mean, I think back on that moment, and I really, really, really regret it.
Yeah, I know. It's very clear in the book. I want to move on to Israel. I mean, you say Israel has five lawyers, and this is the chapter where you talk about Israel's lobby. What do you mean by that? Who are Israel's five lawyers?
Well, I argue that the debate between Israel's supporters and its detractors in America is over. It's been over for quite some time, and the pro-Israeli community has won. And I would argue, with respect to American interests, as long as we don't allow the special relationship, which is driven by shared values, to morph or evolve into an exclusive relationship where we don't take care of our interests as well as Israel's, then we can be okay. And the five lawyers have painted a very compelling case in a democratic system in which lobbying, as long as you do it within legal limits, is one of the virtues and strengths of the system. So Israel has five lawyers. First, a well-organized and affluent Jewish community that has a right to lobby and that has turned Israel into a survival issue. American Jews, roughly 5.5 million, only 2.5 million of which are actually affiliated in any meaningful or serious way with synagogues or organizations. But the 2.5 million who are involved, and particularly the professional and or organized Jewish community, makes an enormous amount of noise, and they have a very influential role. So that's the first. The second is APEC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which, to its credit, has done a masterful job, incredible competence and professionalism, of orchestrating the pro-Israeli community's support in Congress. And it is in Congress where APEC has its primary influence, not on the executive, but in Congress. That's the second lawyer. The third lawyer is the Arab American community, and this is a paradox. They don't intend, obviously, to be Israel's lawyer.
They don't want to make the case for Israel.
But they do, because in identifying themselves with the popular view, the American view, and a lot of this is driven by very unfair and at times, I would argue, racist stereotypes. In identifying themselves, particularly post 9/11, with the popular view, failing to combat it effectively, they emerge as clients of Arab regimes and Arab leaders that simply have no currency in the United States. I point out in the book that the two Mr. A's who are now gone, Mr. Assad and Mr. Arafat, have now been replaced by a third Mr. A, President Ahmadinejad of Iran, who has emerged as the poster child. He's not even an Arab, by the way, as you know.
Yeah, he's Persian. Yeah.
He's Persian. He's emerged as the poster child for validating a closer relationship between the U.S. and the Israelis. So the Arabs essentially become effective advocates for Israel. The fourth lawyer, of course, are evangelical Christians. And I interviewed them all.
Yes.
Jerry Falwell before he died, Ralph Reed, Gary Bauer, Pat Robertson. I even traveled down to San Antonio to take part and witness John Hagee, Pastor John Hagee's Night to Honor Israel, which is essentially 8,000 evangelical Christians in a three-hour professionally staged musical and theatrical production, triumphing the importance of the U.S.-Israeli relationship. And religion doesn't even enter into it. The word Jesus Christ is not mentioned once. It's all about value affinity and how Israel represents American interests. And finally,
I think you do a great job, by the way, when you're dealing with that chapter or the part of the chapter on evangelicals, of showing that it's not kind of an end times belief that drives so many Christians to support Israel, and it's much deeper than that, and that's a misreading.
Right. It's not eschatology. I mean, that's extremely important. It's value affinity. And if you talk to them, you understand that value affinity, the fact that they believe that Israel is more or less like Americans and Israelis are more or less like Americans, becomes the dominant theme in their narrative. And finally, the fifth lawyer is what I call the Jewish lobby of one. And that is the impact that an Israeli prime minister can have in influencing the attitudes and perceptions of American secretaries of state, but particularly American presidents.
Who was, in your estimation, the most effective Israeli prime minister in terms of the relationship with the U.S.?
Well, there's no question that it was Yitzhak Rabin. Okay. Because Rabin represented the balance between toughness and on one hand, and pragmatism and a strategic desire to reach peace with the Arabs on the other. And that, frankly, is the most effective combination. He didn't veer to the right as Menachem Begin did, even though Begin and Carter did develop, even though the trust was ultimately broken, enough of a modus vivendi and a relationship to allow Carter to broker the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, or Yitzhak Shamir, who was perceived to be a sort of drag on moving Israel ahead in its negotiations with
former member, I think, of the Stern Gang.
He was.
Yes. While we're on this topic, very quickly, what's wrong with the Walt Mearsheimer thesis about the Israel lobby?
I think it's monodimensional.
Mm-hmm.
They argue essentially that there is not some conspiracy, but that the Israel
the first paper sounded like a conspiracy. Right, they included you in the lobby.
That's true, but they've walked it back, and I've debated both of them on National Public Radio. The argument, at least, that they're making now is a lot more nuanced. I just think they're wrong. They didn't talk to anybody. They don't know how the system works. They've never been lobbied.
Yeah.
They've never been inside, number one. And I don't want to claim special privilege, but they then didn't go out and talk to anybody. They did no interviews with the lobbyers or the lobbied. And as a consequence, they reached conclusions that I think are wrong. Number one, that the pro-Israeli community was a very influential force in pushing America and the Bush administration into war with Iraq. That's just patently false. Number two, that the lobby, in some respects, holds American foreign policy on the Middle East hostage. And what they don't understand is that, which is number three, look, I'm not here to decry the lobbies. I live in a system. It's imperfect, but I wouldn't substitute it, frankly. The issue is not that lobbies lobby. The issue is, do leaders lead? Do presidents articulate a national interest? And then, in defense of an American interest and, frankly, with a view toward helping both Arabs and Israelis, do they create a policy that's good for America? And when they do, in my judgment, Nixon and Kissinger, Carter, and George H.W. Bush and Jim Baker, lobbies follow. Sometimes there's a fight, but they follow. And you know what? In the end, everybody benefits.
Okay. Well, that is actually... I want to move on. I'm going to ask you a hard question here. Do you think Yasser Arafat betrayed you?
I don't look at the Arab-Israeli conflict. I'm not an Arab, and I'm not an Israeli. I'm an American. I live in Chevy Chase, Maryland. There's no cross-border shelling. There's no terrorism.
But
you've
got a lot of promises from Yasser Arafat.
Not betrayal. I don't look at it that way.
Okay, Arafat, so what is it?
Arafat was a
politician. Because I think he kind of betrayed you and Dennis. I really do.
No. It's too. That's too emotional of an interpretation. The fact is, Arafat was following, perhaps at times, his interests. Or the interests of the Palestinian national movement, but not, in my judgment, the broader interests of the Palestinian public. And Arafat could never make the transition from revolutionary leader in diaspora to statesman and even pragmatic, practical politician at home. And I think that in large part explains much. But in the end, we couldn't do it with Arafat. And it looks to me, and this is the truly tragic part, we can't do it without him. And this is the real problem, not just on the Palestinian side. We lack today the kinds of leaders on both sides that are necessary to lead their respective publics toward the excruciatingly painful challenges that need to be overcome and the decisions that need to be made. And without leadership, you got nothing. And that's part of the problem. These leaders, Mahmoud Abbas, a good, genuine man, wants peace. Ehud Olmert, a good, practical man, wants peace. They just don't have the power. They may have the incentive, but they don't have the power. And you need both. You need to want to do it, and you need to be able to do it. And that is going to be the single greatest challenge that Senator Mitchell faces, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, in the next several years.
Before we get to Senator Mitchell, and I think that is a we'll try to end on that, but I want to just get back to Arafat. There is a moment in the book where you sort of say you're talking about there's a June 24th, 2002 speech from President Bush. I remember as a journalist at the time that you were against the idea of dropping Arafat at that time or in the run up to that, and you're talking about all these events. And there's at one point you sort of said, you know, we should have done more on rule of law. We should have done more on these security courts and human rights, that, you know, the way that Arafat was running his statelet. Do you think that would have, in the end, made a difference? And can you maybe elaborate on what more maybe should have been done in the Oslo years?
Well, we followed Israel's lead on this, frankly.
Yeah.
And this wasn't our show in the early Oslo years. It was Rabin and then Peres. They negotiated these agreements. And the fact is, the Israelis put up with an enormous amount from the Palestinians. They put up with Arafat's acquiescence to terror. They put up with incitement. They put up with his state security courts. They put up with the entire authoritarian structure that he had created in an effort to reach an agreement with him. And by implication, since we more or less during those years followed the Israelis around, which is one of my complaints,
yes,
we did too. So Bill Clinton, who hosted Arafat in the Oval Office more than any other world leader in the year 2000, wasn't tough enough with Arafat on incitement, on conditioning young Palestinians in the images of martyrdom and anti-Semitism.
What about just human rights? I mean, he would seize his opponent's bank accounts. He would, you know, there was, you know, awful conditions that happened in some of those preventive security services jails against people who may have been innocents.
Right. I mean, all life is relative, and Arafat wasn't authoritarian, but his human rights abuses were certainly far less than the authoritarian Arab regimes, including our very close friends, the Egyptians. Not to mention the Saudis when it comes to torture and knocks on the door in the middle of the night. But we were not, you're absolutely right, we were not tough enough. And neither were the Israelis with Mr. Arafat's behavior.
Do you think that the corruption and some of the things that were tolerated with Arafat may have seeded the ground in some ways or prepared the ground for the rise of Hamas in the 2006 election?
There's no question that that Fatah's dysfunction, its corruption, its division created an opportunity for an organization, Hamas, the religious manifestation of Palestinian nationalism, by its own focus and its discipline, its capacity to provide through its dawah, the social and economic programs and outreach that it manages to create for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, absolutely provided an opening. And that opening, I might add, in view of Abu Mazen Mahmoud Abbas's weakness is still there even after the fact that the Israelis dealt Hamas a powerful military blow in recent weeks.
Well, is it possible to have a deal with Hamas?
In my judgment, no.
Why not?
First of all, you need one gun, one authority, one negotiating position.
Right.
So without a unified Palestinian house, you basically can hang a close for the season sign on any prospects of an Israeli-Palestinian agreement. It's not going to happen. And right now, talking to Hamas, in my judgment, is a key to an empty room. It's simply going to undermine Mahmoud Abbas. It's going to drive the Israelis crazy for no reason. And it's going to create a major political headache for a president, Barack Obama, who has many other priorities, including ushering and shepherding through Congress almost a trillion-dollar stimulus package, which most Americans do care about. So,
right.
No, I don't agree for now, and with no strategy, on any effort to bring Hamas into an American fold. It'll fail.
So so now let's get back to Mitchell and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and I guess Dan Shapiro and other. I mean, what is the new peace team? What should they do?
Well, in my view, the strategy should be very, very clear. Number one, you've got to stabilize the situation in Gaza. You need a ceasefire brokered by the Egyptians. Without that, nothing is going to be possible. Number two, you've got to find a way to facilitate on a regular, consistent, and transparent basis humanitarian and economic assistance in order to provide for the needs of Palestinians and to rebuild Gaza. Number three, you've got to find a way to staunch and contain and constrain Hamas's capacity to re-import arms. But even while you do that, you have to recognize, in my view, that the possibility of a conflict-ending agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, which conclusively resolves borders, Jerusalem, refugees, and security, the chances of that happening, in my view, anytime soon are slim to none. The real deal is not between Israelis and Palestinians. The real deal and the possible deal is a peace treaty between Israel and Syria. That is doable. It'll be excruciatingly painful, but it can be done, and it would rearrange or begin to rearrange the regional furniture in a way that would definitely strengthen America's credibility and further its interests.
On Syria, how do you do that and at the same time honor the UN investigation into the murder of Hariri?
That's a very good and very tricky question. But I would argue to you that just as we managed to fix or address the issue of Pan Am 103, in which the Libyan government, probably at its highest reaches, was responsible for killing almost 300 Americans in that terrorist attack. Do you think we're going to allow an investigation into the tragic assassination, criminal assassination of a Lebanese prime minister to basically undermine the chances of an Israeli-Syrian agreement? There will be a way, but I'm afraid it will not bring the kind of satisfaction to the March 14th movement, those Lebanese rallying around the current prime minister, Fouad Siniora, or to those supporters of Lebanon. The Syrians...
What about the broader question of will a peace deal between Syria and Israel mean that Syria will be able to go back to the Taif Accord agreement with regards to Lebanon?
I think, on balance, an Israeli-Syrian peace treaty and a longer-term effort to wean the Syrians into a more aligned pro-European and pro-Western camp with hundreds of millions of dollars of economic assistance, the end to Syria's isolation. Of course, there are things the Syrians are going to have to do, will ultimately benefit the Lebanese. Because you are ultimately going to also have to negotiate an Israeli-Lebanese peace treaty.
Well, yes, but I mean, how do you deal with the problem that a lot of Lebanese that I talk to now feel that it's almost as if Syria and, more importantly, Hezbollah may have carte blanche to assassinate and bully politicians with whom they disagree, to undermine the fragile political process in Beirut?
Well, I would argue that in the wake of an Israeli-Syrian peace treaty, much of that, certainly a serious support for Hezbollah, its military support for Hezbollah would have to come to an end.
Okay.
You can't have an Israeli-Syrian peace treaty and having Damascus be the transit point, either for its own military support for Syria or allowing the Iranians to do it. And such an Israeli-Syrian agreement would pose Hezbollah and the Iranians and Hamas with some very tricky choices. I would argue over time it'll reduce their leverage. But again, I don't want to trivialize the degree of difficulty of achieving an Israeli-Syrian peace treaty. An Israeli prime minister and a Syrian president will have to meet one another's, their mutual requirements probably 100%, and an American president, in this case Barack Obama, is going to have to get personally involved. You cannot subcontract this out to your Secretary of State or to an envoy.
Hmm.
He's going to have to get involved.
Well, let me ask you one more question about Syria, Israel. How do you deal with this problem? Syria is in Iran's orbit right now, and we know that Iran is a terrible enemy to have. But because America is, you know, I guess is an advanced democracy. How do you convince Bashar Assad that it's going to be worth it for you in some ways to betray the Iranians or to move away from the Iranians, who can be absolutely terrible enemies to you and will do things that if you betray or you go against the Americans, you know, we won't do to you?
Well, remember, the Syrian-Iranian relationship works both ways. It's a 30-year relationship.
Yes.
And the Syrians have benefited from it as well. It won't be easy. But it seems to me that if you compare the benefits that the Syrians derive from their relationship with Iran, on one hand, against the potential benefits of what could accrue to the Syrians if, in fact, they signed a peace treaty with Israel, there's almost no comparison. And at the same time, I might add, we are going to have to begin, even though it may be another key to an empty room, we're going to have to begin talking to the Iranians in a very serious way. Not on our knees, but we're going to have to start talking to the Iranians as part of the strategy.
What do you think we should talk to the Iranians about?
Well, there are any number of issues, from Afghanistan to post-withdrawal scenarios in Iraq, to Lebanon, to their support for Hamas, to the nuclear issue, to the Arab-Israeli issue, to frozen assets. I mean, there is a negotiating agenda with Iran that will take years to go through. And if sanctions don't work and military force is the last resort,
sure,
then we ought to give this we ought to try this, not for its own sake. I'm tired of hearing the word engagement. It's been stripped of all possible.
Well, there has been a lot of, like, you know, there have been a lot of engagement indirectly and, you know, back channel with Iran for 30 years. I mean, there's been a lot of discussions.
Right, but we're not talking about back channel now. We're talking about a relationship that can be sustainable in the light of day. And by the way, whether you agree with it or not, U.S.-Iranian engagement is coming to a theater near you very soon.
Yeah, I think that's right. Let me just ask you the last thing, and I know you got to go. How do you do U.S.-Iranian engagement without legitimizing what I would say is the Jewish eliminationism of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad?
Very, very difficult. I mean, it will be fascinating to see, because it's not Ahmadinejad's call. It's the supreme leader's call.
Khamenei. It is, but the supreme leader is just as lunatic as...
No, I'm saying whether or not the June elections result, you could have a new president in June.
Yeah, it's true.
And if you do, then Mr.
And that opens everything up. I agree with you. But if you still have somebody, if you still have Ahmadinejad or someone like Ahmadinejad, how do you have open meetings with the Iranians and at the same time say that you're not I mean, I think that there was a deliberate strategy in the last few years for the president of Iran to basically, you know, call for the destruction of a member of state of the UN in Israel and to say the Holocaust never happened. And it's sort of, at first, it shocks the conscience. But then over time, the idea is that you just come to accept it.
It's a very good point, Eli. It's not, as far as I'm concerned, it's not sustainable. We can't be involved in a dialogue with Iran if Iranian behavior, including Iranian rhetoric, continues to be what it has been.
Okay.
Because every time Hezbollah does something, every time Hamas does something, every time Ahmadinejad talks about denial of the Holocaust, and Khamenei, who is the one who really does exercise real influence and power, does nothing about it.
Right.
America is caught in this investment trap, and it looks weak and pathetic.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, so there's a hope that you can see the coming to a theater near you, the U.S.-Iranian engagement, but there's going to need to be a new president, probably.
Well, I am under no illusions that this efforts to get this thing started are going to be anything but bumpy and incredibly fractious and controversial. And that's the real challenge for the new administration, how to make this work without appearing to be engaging the Iranians, as I mentioned before, on our knees.
All right. Well, Aaron David Miller, thank you so much for coming on to Blogging Hands Like This. I highly recommend people getting The Much Too Promised Land. It is, even if you don't agree with everything in the book, if you're coming more from the center right, it's really well worth reading and probably one of the best memoirs of the peace process genre.
I might add, Eli, that MuchToPromisedLand.com is an extraordinary website which has excerpts of many of the interviews that I've done with former secretaries of state and presidents. So it's worth taking a look at, MuchToPromisedLand.com.
And also, you also will find when you read the book that you catch a lot of blue language from people that you didn't expect to throw such F-bombs.
A lot of four-letter words in this book.
A lot of four-letter words.
And I didn't utter any of them.
No. All right. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.